Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's rejection of a cooperative housing proposal.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
The fate of the Limestone City Cooperative Housing Project came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night, where they ultimately decided the project will have to fend for itself to secure the intended property at 900 Division Street. Limestone City Cooperative Housing, LCCH, is a nonprofit aiming to build an innovative cooperative housing and vertical farm project, providing 284 affordable housing units in the city's north end. Meadowbrook Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren has been working on the project for the last 2 years. In September, council turned down a request for $2 million in seed funding for the project, sending LCCH the message that a clearer vision for the project would be needed to win over council. On Tuesday, council was presented with two options: to hand over the city-owned property at 900 Division Street to LCCH or to put the property on the open market, meaning LCCH, a nonprofit, would have to compete with private developers for the land. Proponents of the project presented before council to support the project with option one. Remy Strauss, a business expert backing LCCH, was one of the representatives that presented the case before council.
While this is really big today, I think I question for you as to whether you want to see buildings as just places where people live. Or are they perhaps a backbone for a thriving community? Are they perhaps more than just somewhere to live, but they're actually about addressing many more issues?
Councillor McLaren also emphasized the importance of choosing option one for LCCH, with the major hurdle being that the project cannot secure identified grant funding before securing land.
There's $127 million that we have identified that we can go after, but it's conditional on the land. We need that land to get the money. What I'm asking you guys here for today with option one is to help us, to authorize us, to give us the direction to go out and get a $127 million investment in affordable housing, in solutions to climate change, in solutions to food insecurity. This is absolutely critical in our community. We've declared emergencies in all of these things.
Councillors Connie Glenn and Gary Osteroff expressed their support for option one.
I think we owe it to ourselves as a community to at least make the attempt for a big reach, something that is going to solve multiple issues, multiple problems, and maybe set the stage for something brand new for other communities as well. So I'd like to see this move forward. Let's give an opportunity to this city to really shine and to see what we can actually bring.
I'm going to support this project. I've been a bit of a critic of it as well, and Jeff has heard me out a few times, but I did go to a board meeting recently and as a visitor, and I've been listening closer, and I think, as Councillor Glenn has said, a year ago we had a report that we sent back, pretty clear message. And I think that what we see now is something that is very attractive. This is really got to it, it. There's a lot of check marks that we can now look at this and say, this is worth looking at. I think we should give this project the confidence that it needs tonight with option one. Really, it's inherently risk free for us, and the upside is just so high.
However, while a major selling point for the project had been the lack of risk for the city, Mayor Brian Patterson brought in another perspective.
Do I want to see this project go forward? Of course. I think that the issue is that it's not risk-free for the city because we only have so much land available. I'm not trying to be negative, but I am trying to be honest. So this is what due diligence looks like. So we need to weigh that out.
Option one did not make it through, with only Councillors Osteroth, Glenn, McLaren, and Lisa Osanek in support. Councillor McLaren made a final impassioned speech, stressing the position of LCCH if the land is put out on the market, and urged council to reconsider.
If we're going to put this on the market, there is a long process. And it's an uncertain process, one that will close windows, that will make this harder for us. It creates uncertainty, and in fact, it's going to kill this project. We are not equipped to play or to compete in a for-profit shark-infested ocean.
Councillor Osanek expressed the disappointment of supporters of the project.
Option two is why innovation dies. I feel so strongly. I've been on planning committee for 18 of my 19 years. This is 248 affordable housing units that are 65% of market rate. I am so angry. It is so hard to get affordable housing units built in this city. Every single big tower, we always ask for affordable housing. The answer is always zero units. This is 248 right here in our hands that could have been on city land. So let's just see what happens with this option two that is probably going to pass right now. What we get is going to be at the very best purpose-built apartment. That will be the best. At the worst, it's going to be a tall condo. Tall condo. And how many affordable housing units will be in there? None. This is what we just gave up. 248 affordable housing units. I cannot believe in a housing crisis that we just said no to that.
When option two came forward, Councillor Brandon Tozzo made his case as the councillor of the district the project would take root in.
This project had more red flags than Soviet Russia. Assumptions of grant funding and financing that it hasn't really been proven. And this is a public piece of land. A point I also want to make is I'm the councillor of the district that this property is in. I have seen in my time on council a variety of different brilliant ideas proposed in the north end of Kingston that each have really unique features. And this is about the third or fourth time I've experienced this, and this seems to only happen in Kingston's north end. And let it be said, every single time in the previous report that we had on affordable housing, I voted in favor of this. I'm a fan of affordable housing, but I am kind of getting sick of being the city's social engineering experiment for the rest of the town. This is the north end, and I know it has had a lot of inequality and marginalization. This amount of affordable housing, staff recommend in the initial report that was supposed to have five affordable houses, that was ignored. The staff think that it could have a limitation of six stories, that was ignored. This is a kind of an affront to me as the district counselor that none of those considerations were even considered. So there was also a public meeting that Limestone Co-op had months ago, where I wasn't invited as the district counselor. I actually asked about it and didn't get a response from the board. Thanks, guys. Really awesome. So on the merits of this project, I think it's just inherently flawed. I'm not going to be charitable about this. I kind of call a spade a spade. I'm voting against this. I think we should sell the land, put that directly into affordable housing, and we can actually get some affordable housing built. That's where I stand on this. Good luck in the free market getting this.
Option 2 passed with a vote of 7-4. While this means LCCH still has the opportunity to compete for the land, as Councillor McLaren stated, this could mean the end of the project. According to the motion, the city has the intent of reallocating revenue from selling the land to an affordable housing project located in another area of the city. This has been Christina Lurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the potential for landfill mining in the township of Leeds and Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Jesse. Lansdowne's waste disposal site is running out of time, but a new plan could extend its life for decades while saving the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands millions of dollars. TLTI Council will consider a recommendation to move forward with a landfill mining project at the Lansdowne waste disposal site. With only 3 to 4 years of capacity left before the site must transition into a costly waste transfer facility, Council is being urged to apply for federal funding through the Canada Housing Infrastructure Fund to support the mining initiative. A recent feasibility study found that excavating 68,000 cubic meters of material would free up 40,000 cubic meters of additional space at the landfill, effectively extending its lifespan by 10 to 20 years. Coupled with a recent environmental compliance approval update that removes final cover from the approved waste volume, the site could see an additional 5 to 15 years of capacity, potentially pushing the site's usefulness well beyond 2040. If the landfill reaches capacity as expected, TLTI will be forced to operate a waste transfer station with household garbage shipped off-site at an estimated cost of $67 million over 30 years, excluding inflation and potential tariffs. The proposed mining project comes with an upfront cost of $5.4 million, but is projected to save TLTI more than $50 million over the next 3 decades. If the CHIF grant is approved, the federal government would cover 50% of the capital costs, cutting the township's financial burden in half. Currently, TLTI has earmarked $698,200 in its 2025 capital budget for the project. Should the grant application succeed, the remaining $2 million needed for the township's share will be phased into future budgets. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with his Kingston Sports Recap.
Thank you, Dinah. It is banner season in the city of Kingston as several local teams enter the final phases of their seasons. The Cinderella run of the Queens men's basketball team came to an abrupt end in Vancouver last week. Expectations for the 2025 Gales were tempered after an outstanding 2024 campaign. The team lost a number of experienced players and key rotation pieces, but despite these losses, the 2025 Gales came out of the gates hot and secured their place in the OUA playoffs. Few expected the Gales to perform at this level, but outstanding play from young players like first-year phenom Ollie Engen helped them make it back to the Wilson Cup final. Though they would lose to the Ottawa Gigis in the Ontario Championship, the Gales booked their spot to the national top 8. Unfortunately, Queens would be unable to replicate their regular season success at the national level, falling to the Calgary Dinos in the first round and the UBC Thunderbirds in the consolation semifinals. Another Queens team booked their trip to the national finals as the Queens men's hockey team shut out the Toronto Varsity Blues 4-0 to secure a berth in the U Sports University Cup tournament. The Gales play the Saskatchewan Huskies on March 21st in Ottawa. The Kingston Frontenacs will wrap up their regular season this weekend with games against Peterborough and Brampton. The Fronts are currently in third place in the Eastern Conference. If they maintain that position, they will play the Sudbury Wolves in the first round of the OHL playoffs. If the Oshawa Generals leapfrog the Fronts, Kingston will have a tougher matchup against the Brampton Steelheads. And that's a wrap for your Kingston Sports Report. Back to you, Dinah.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the future development of a new subdivision in Odessa.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council approved the draft plan for a subdivision in Odessa that would include 584 new residential units. Creekford Developments submitted the plan at Council's meeting this week. The proposed subdivision is located south of County Road 2 in the west end of Odessa. The 584 units would include 390 semi-detached units and 194 single-detached units. 4 new streets are proposed along with the subdivision, as well as extensions of Babcock Boulevard and Fields Way. The site also contains an environmental protection block, 2 park blocks, and a multi-use path that connects the south end of the development and County Road 2. Staff's report noted the design of the subdivision complements the layout of the adjacent Babcock Mills neighborhood, which is expected to reach full build-out by 2025. A statutory public meeting was held April 24, 2023, where a number of residents detailed concerns regarding regarding parking, drainage, park location, school capacity, traffic design, and speed enforcement. At their November 26, 2024 meeting, council brought these concerns to the company and directed them to bring forward a new draft, which is now approved. Approvals planner David Casemore explains the benefits of the proposed subdivision.
From the planning perspective, the design is doesn't consume too much land. It is compact in its form and provides housing types that aren't readily available in Odessa. Appears to conform to the Planning Act, the provincial policy statement 2024, the official plan of the township and the county.
Casemore speaks about public input from residents.
Public comments, we really haven't received any except for that from that first public meeting. The consultant had made quite a few changes. We had had a lot of feedback from council and the public at that point, but once those changes were made moving forward, we really didn't hear anything come from the public from that perspective.
Casemore outlined some of the work and studies that went into the plan.
We did have a few peer reviews on traffic, noise, as well as environmental impact assessment that was done. The arborist for the applicant worked with our peer reviewer and met some requirements that the MECP had regarding species at risk. The traffic consultant worked with our engineering department, instituted some traffic calming, jut outs, roundabouts, etc.
Based on the direction received from township staff during the pre-consultation meeting, the primary entrance to the development will be located at the northwestern end of the site on the south side of Main Street. The report noted most of the commercial development and institutional facilities within Odessa are located along Main Street, with Ernesttown Secondary School, Odessa Public School, a local convenience store, three churches, and the Loyalist Fire Department all situated within 600 meters of the northern boundary of the site. A sidewalk along the southern side of Main Street and a marked pedestrian crossing connect these services to the site. Full transit service is not currently available in Odessa, but the report noted that should it be introduced, the grid pattern of the street design and connection to the adjacent subdivision will allow for logical route planning through the area.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Back to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM, Christina Laurie, with an update on labor action at Queen's University.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. What you just heard is the main strike line in front of Stauffer Library at the intersection of Union and University, as over 2,000 graduate students are now on strike after negotiations with the university failed to yield a new collective agreement. After 15 hours of bargaining leading up to the deadline on Sunday, March 9th, picket lines have been set up at entrances across Queen's campus since Monday morning. Some of the union's demands that have not been met include a guaranteed funding model, compensation for the creation of course content, and tuition relief. PSAC Local 901 Union President Jake Morrow spoke with CFRC at the picket line on campus.
What's the experience been at the picket line these past few days?
The experience is joyful. It's a tough thing to go on strike, but our membership has shown up in huge numbers, in growing numbers every day. Got over 1,000 folks so far signed up for picket shifts over the next couple days. We've got solidarity and support coming from CUFA, from local councillors and politicians, from the other unions on campus, from national unions and labor organizations, from local unions such as bus drivers, transit. We've got solidarity and support coming from everybody. You can hear the honking in the background. We're just taking the first couple days to practice some logistics of what it means to be on strike, and we are getting ready to shut this university down. We got 2,000 members who are getting ready to shut this university down and a whole community.
And you mentioned some of the support you're getting there. What support are you seeing from students, your fellow faculty and staff?
Just love. Just how do we help? How are you in such poverty? How is it so embarrassing to be at Queen's University in this moment? We're getting solidarity, love, and support from undergrads, and we want to keep seeing it.
While Queen's has stated that classes and academic activities will continue as scheduled, some undergraduate students are seeing classes canceled or otherwise impacted, with many relying on teaching assistants, research assistants, and teaching fellows for tutorials, labs, and grading. Queen's faculty are also able to choose not to cross the picket line on ideological grounds without repercussions. Nathan Percy, a first-year Queen's Law student, shared his thoughts on his professors choosing to continue classes.
It hasn't directly affected most of our classes, actually, which is something that irks me personally. I know that the QUFA union members, which I believe are the faculty, would be the main professors, have a provision in their collective bargaining agreement that allows them to not cross picket lines on ideological grounds or make that decision with no recourse. And all of my professors have elected to continue in-person classes. So it hasn't really affected our main courses. One course of ours, Introduction to Legal Studies, has TAs and heavily relies on TAs to facilitate and mark assignments. So that's the only one where it's kind of up in the air, and we haven't had received any communications regarding how we're affected, let alone what it will be affected. I know some of my friends said their TA was out on the picket line, so we really have no idea. Usually we have that class on Tuesday, and we didn't even get an email about it, so we'll see what happens. I think it, you know, heavily depends on how long the strike goes, obviously.
While law classes have been minimally impacted so far, Percy spoke to how the strike has changed how he shows up on campus.
I have two classes that I have to attend to get our participations are a large part of our mark, and so therefore attendances. And so I will attend for those, but I have skipped the rest of my classes, and I won't use the library or the ARC or anything in accordance with PSAC's requests. It's funny. I don't know how much like the rest of my class engages in that kind of action. I actually had one of my peers ask me, why are they asking us not to use the library or the ARC? You know, we pay for those. Why would we stop using them? I wonder how much people and even my peers in law school really understand about what a strike is substantively outside of, the workers are still working.
Percy also elaborated on what he has been hearing from his peers on the subject.
I think it's very mixed. I think I certainly have peers who share my view on the labor dispute, and we pretty much agree with everything when we talk to each other. But I also have peers who, like I said, aren't outwardly anti-union. I haven't really heard a lot of that sentiment, to be fair. But I have heard a lot of like I spoke to before, owing to like a certain confusion or a lack of true understanding of like what labor disputes like this like mean.
In their latest statement, the university simply stated that it remains committed to working with the union to reach an agreement that both parties can ratify.
What's outrageous? What's outrageous?
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the, quote, state of disrepair for the Nahuatl Nature Sanctuary.
It wasn't the outcome one volunteer wanted for a nature sanctuary on the shores of Lake Ontario near Grafton, but raising awareness to the disrepair of the sanctuary has raised alarm bells with Township of Allanuck Haldimand Council and staff. Lori Maitland, who lives near the Nahuatl Nature Sanctuary, was hoping the township would create a standalone committee to address the urgent needs of the sanctuary, rather than amalgamating the Nahuatl Advisory Committee with the Recreation, Culture, and Community Development Advisory Committee as a unified Parks and Recreation Advisory Committee, suggesting the township, which is responsible for the sanctuary's upkeep, has been non-existent.
It's hard to argue that the level of care has diminished and the park has fallen into a state of disrepair. Not only have the invasive weeds become more prevalent, but the walking path has become inaccessible. Items of concern like fallen trees, deteriorating covered bridge structure now represent safety hazards and an increased township liability risk.
The Newhatten Sanctuary Association folded in 2020 after nearly 20 years of maintaining it. Since then, the township has taken responsibility. Despite allocating funds and conducting studies, Maitland told Council Tuesday that it has ignored the sanctuary, leaving it to the general public to perform minor cleanup.
Frustration has grown amongst residents. Had those individuals not stepped up, the neglect would have resulted in a much worse park condition and possible visitor injury. It was residents who removed the falling branches from the walking paths. It was residents that removed the larger patches of poison ivy.
Township Chief Administrative Officer Dave Dawson agreed with Maitland's assessment of the sanctuary, saying her presentation was spot on and extremely truthful. Maitland argued that the amalgamated 12-member Park and Recreation Advisory Committee may not give the sanctuary the attention it deserves, yet council voted 3-2 to merge the committees. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 20th, we're going to see a daytime high of 7 degrees, and there is a 60% chance of showers throughout the day. Friday, March 21st, it's going to be 3 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. Saturday, March 22nd, a little bit warmer at 9 degrees. It will be cloudy, dropping down to as low as minus 2 overnight. Sunday, March 23rd, daytime high of 5 degrees and it will be cloudy. And Monday, March 24th, high of 7, but a 40% chance of precipitation. Coming up next, your City of Kingston traffic report. Reminder that reduced load restrictions are in effect in Kingston as of March 1st. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Work is still ongoing at the Hanson Memorial parking structure. This work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is planned to conclude in July 2025. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic coming from the Wabin Crossing.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.